Why do some people have more power than others? Why do kings pass on their power to their oldest sons? What makes one person more eligible to be in charge than another person? And does power always corrupt? We are beginning a new theme study here on the podcast. It's a theme we're calling the firstborn. And it's really a theme about, well, who gets to be in charge, who gets to have power, and how will they use it?
The idea appears in the first pages of the Bible, connected to the phrase, image of God. You could argue this is one of the dominant themes of Genesis. In terms of the New Testament, the firstborn is a title ascribed to Jesus multiple places in the New Testament, in the letters of Paul two times, in the letter to the Hebrews, and in the last book of the Christian Bible, the Revelation. So it goes from end to end, and it's kind of like once you see how the theme works, then you can't unsee it. You just start to see it everywhere.
I'm a firstborn child in my family, and while I got to do a lot of things first among my siblings, I wasn't really given a special position or privilege in my family because of birth order. But in the ancient world, being the firstborn son was extremely special. The firstborn was meant to carry on the family legacy, to receive a double portion of inheritance. They're given the unique authority and power of the family.
And really, this is all just a main theme in Genesis about humans discerning good and bad. The basic human assumption when it comes to the good and bad and the future of the family is that the firstborn son should be elevated overall. And sometimes what these humans do to put a son in that position of firstborn or to produce that firstborn causes pain and grief and division and abuse. And so what God is constantly doing is subverting and overturning human assumptions about power and privilege.
As we unpack this theme, we're going to see he frequently picks the secondborn or the latecomer. He picks the less likely, the oppressed, the overlooked, and he chooses them to be the leader.
Spoiler, the God portrayed in the Bible consistently, and by consistently meaning in almost every generation, is overturning and inverting this cultural assumption that the firstborn should have the right to the father's authority or priority.
Today, Tim Mackey and I begin the theme of the firstborn. I'm John Collins. You're listening to Bible Project Podcast. Thanks for joining us. Here we go. Okay.
Okay, let's see where this goes.
So we're going to start a new theme.
Yes.
Video discussion.
Yeah. Feels like it's been a while for us. Well, in real time,
yeah.
At least.
In real time for us, it's been a while.
Yeah.
But it might be that this also is the first to come out.
That's right.
Since our whole movement.
Yeah.
Reading through the Torah in movements.
Right. Where we talked
which took all year, basically.
The first, five scrolls of the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
Which was awesome.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. So, yeah, but what we're going to do in this series is dive into a theme, biblical theme, trace it from the first pages of the Christian Bible to the end, and it's all in prep connected to a theme video
yes.
that we're going to be releasing at some point in the Bible Project future for us.
Yeah.
It might be past, depending on when you're listening to this.
It's actually slotted to come out for Christmas.
Oh.
22.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great. And when you say it, John, what is the it? What is the theme video that we're going to be discussing?
The theme video, you call it the firstborn.
The firstborn, yes.
The theme of the firstborn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a very, that's a very kind of in the weeds, geeky Bible idea.
Yeah. It's maybe not the first thing that somebody would maybe think of as a like prominent theme that runs throughout the Bible.
Yeah.
But it is. Oh, but it is. You know, we've had some theme videos that feel pretty intuitive, you know, heaven and earth. You know, those two words are in the first line of the first sentence of the Bible.
Right.
We've done ones on God.
Yeah. The Messiah.
The Messiah, Holy Spirit. Mm. But then we've done ones that I think are important. They're like sleeper themes where they're right there. They actually pervade everything, but they maybe don't come up in terms of being mentioned all the time. Hmm. The image of God is like this. Hmm. It's just a phrase that is only used two times in two occasions in Genesis, and then a few times in the New Testament. But as we've discovered over the years, that idea underlies every single page of Scripture. Hmm. And the story of the Bible doesn't make a lot of sense without understanding that idea. So that's an example.
Okay, yeah.
So firstborn is kind of like that. And actually, it's connected.
It appears a lot more than the image of God, though.
Oh, firstborn? That's true. Yeah, yeah, that's right. And actually, the idea of the firstborn is intimately connected to the theme of the image of God.
Hmm. Cool.
As we will discover.
Great.
But yeah, so the theme of the firstborn, it fits our categories for a theme. It appears, the idea appears in the first pages of the Bible, connected to the phrase, image of God.
Okay.
But then the idea of some sort of conflict over the status of the firstborn.
Yeah, that's Cain and Abel.
Comes right to the surface. And Cain and Abel, though, as we're going to see later in this conversation, that's actually the second cycle of that theme, not the first. It appears the idea of the firstborn getting inverted or subverted, or the rights or authority of a firstborn getting turned upside down, given to a younger sibling. You could argue this is one of the dominant themes of Genesis.
Right.
And it echoes throughout the rest of the Hebrew Bible. And then in terms of the New Testament, the firstborn is a title ascribed to Jesus multiple places in the New Testament, in the letters of Paul two times, in the letter to the Hebrews, and in the last book of the Christian Bible, the Revelation. So it goes from end to end.
Yeah.
It does. And it's kind of like once you see how the theme works, then you can't unsee it. You just start to see it everywhere. So that's at least why I guess I'm making a case.
You're making a case that it is a theme.
Yeah, totally.
All right.
Yeah.
I believe you.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't have to
try
to convince me.
Yeah.
But that's a good overview, I suppose. So firstborn, I think at a first blush, for some reason for me, it might feel completely disorienting. What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
But I think actually for many cultures, it's really important.
Yep.
Who's the firstborn of the family? Mm-hmm. I'm a firstborn.
Yes, you are. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so funny. Yeah. Some people are really into birth order.
Yeah.
Like it's one of the first things they ask when they meet somebody
or
you know, as they're getting to know somebody.
Yeah.
It's like, my wife's like this.
Okay.
If she's getting to know someone by the second or third conversation.
You're acting like a middle child.
She was. Totally. Yeah. Or the firstborn. Or the, third.
Or the youngest.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, I don't know, family systems research that has gone into this. And there are like typical patterns, right, that shape the mentality and developing psychology of a human based on their birth order. Mm. Right? I think it
must be.
Yeah.
It must shape you in some way.
Yes. Not to say always in the exact same way.
Yeah.
I bet there's people listening to this conversation who could give us a lecture right now on these things. So what you're naming, aside from that, is just that there is a cultural practice that pops up in human societies and cultural traditions throughout all of human history in all parts of where humans have ever been, of this practice of the firstborn child, and in patriarchal cultures, the firstborn male child, the firstborn son, having a place of special honor in terms of responsibility, authority, maybe the future of the inheritance or estate or wealth, property of the family, and that the firstborn son bears some special role.
Probably a majority of human history and a majority of places that was at play to some degree.
Yeah.
It's not, like I said, I'm the firstborn in my family.
Yes.
And I had no special, like, I wasn't treated differently. I didn't get a different status, inheritance, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just not a normal thing in our culture.
That's right.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that has to do with the fact that you and I are in a culture that right now stands at the end of a long process of creating a whole new story about human identity and value and worth that's not tied to how most human cultures have thought about these things for most of human history.
Yeah.
So we're the outlier. If you think, well, firstborn, secondborn, what does it matter?
Yeah.
If that's your mindset approaching this topic, And, you know, that's my cultural upbringing too. Yeah. Then what that shows is that I'm a minority in human right. history and thinking about.
So the biblical authors are writing in a context where it matters so much.
Matters a lot.
A lot.
Yeah. In an interesting way, though, because the biblical authors—
Not in the way you would expect.
But not in the way you would expect.
Yeah, they're going to subvert the norm.
Yeah, spoiler, the God portrayed in the Bible consistently, and by consistently, meaning in almost every generation, is overturning and inverting this cultural assumption that the firstborn should have the right to the father's authority or priority, kind of. Well, yeah, in terms of human partners.
Yeah.
But then when you probe a layer deeper, and what you see coming out in the New Testament is that the status of a firstborn is like baked into the structure of the universe.
Okay.
So anyway.
We're just spinning all around it.
We are, yeah. Okay, but we're just naming that this, the technical term, if you look in biblical studies, theological literature, sociological literature, is called the law of primogeniture, which is a Latin phrase, primo meaning first, and genitor meaning like descendant, offspring, lineage, the first.
This is Latin?
Latin.
Yeah.
Primogeniture.
The first of the...
The first of the offspring.
Offspring.
First of the descendants, yeah.
Do we need a fancy Latin word just to make ourselves feel special?
I'm just saying, like, if you start looking for this theme described
okay.
by biblical scholars and theologians, the phrase is the law of primogeniture. But that's it. The practice that a firstborn son is somehow a special, unique representative of the father. This is a patriarchal institution.
Yeah.
In kind of male dominant cultures, that the firstborn son, by natural right, assumes the responsibility, authority, and representation of the father, his wealth, power, authority, and the future of the estate. So it's against that cultural backdrop that the biblical story is going to just, from the first pages, start just doing twists
start
and
messing
turns
with it.
And inversions. And the shock factor of all those inversions won't really land unless you get that basic cultural assumption that's in the background.
Should we start there then? Should we start with kind of trying to be sympathetic with that cultural assumption?
Okay. Yeah, sure. We can also problematize it a little bit because as I looked into this topic, especially in an ancient Near Eastern cultural background, things were a little more complicated.
Okay.
But sure, yeah. Do you want to lead us in the exercise of the imagination?
Well, you know, we got to imagine you're living in a culture where your security. And your well-being all depends on your family structure.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, sure.
You don't have some other employer, you know, that can you have like stock with or a retirement pension plan with. You don't have the government have with some sort of safety net. Mm-hmm. Like you have your family.
Yeah. Your family is your present and future web of safety.
Yeah.
And stability. Yeah. That's right. That is how most human societies have operated for most of human history.
And when it comes to then, how is the family going to continue to work generation after generation?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to lead the family?
Yeah. Yep.
Then there has to be someone who's responsible for making sure the family's taken care of and basically becomes the little king of the of this tiny tribe, I suppose.
Yeah. Yep.
Which is often, in most cultures, a patriarch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, what's interesting to think about, though, is that, and this is where I don't know, because the biblical story doesn't take place in or wasn't written in a time when humans were in hunter-gatherer stage, you know?
It was during the agricultural
So it's kind of the assumed state of the ideal state of a family within the biblical story is settled on the land that is abundant.
Mm-hmm. Farming the land.
With an extended family that provides safety, stability, and order.
Yeah.
So what I don't know is whether something like the law of the firstborn or the practice of elevating the firstborn, if that held in previous stages of human society developing.
And like a hunter-gatherer.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
That's interesting. No, well, I mean, from the very little I've heard, it sounds like there was less of a sense of ownership of things. Everything just was a lot more shared in hunter-gatherer
communities. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Because, it's not about, your family identity, wealth production isn't necessarily tied to a piece of land.
Yeah, you actually don't, you don't own land, you're moving around.
Yeah.
Everything's shared.
Yeah.
There's not a lot to inherit or disinherit. You just kind of like, everyone's helping each other.
Okay.
Kinship. It's almost like everyone's part of, if you're in the tribe, you're in the family.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
But I don't know a ton. But.
Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting little side trail to flag. But in the biblical story and the cultural background of the biblical authors where that all takes place, it's the biblical authors and Israel, this is Israelite literature, their first place of existing was in a land, a federation of tribes, in the settled agricultural life there. And that society was structured, patriarchally, in terms of like extended families and that with patriarchs. And then all of a sudden, who will carry the leadership and hold the security and property of the family through each generation? And here we come into why the law or the practice of the firstborn, how it fits in terms of a structure of a family and a society.
And I'm sure it depended, actual benefits of a firstborn probably changed from generation, like different times of human history, even within Israel, I suppose. But was there a general kind of rule of like the firstborn gets like a double portion?
Or? So this is debated.
Okay.
Because our ancient evidence is very thin, actually. But sorry, just one more note before we do that. Just children in general play a different role in cultural imagination in that kind of society.
Uh-huh.
Because children are also producers and protectors of family wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Farmhands.
Yeah.
Like they're your first laborers, to help you. And so having large families is a sign of abundance and adds to your security. The more children, the more abundance and security that there is. And so there's something about the first of those. And, maybe here we can jump out of trying to sympathetically imagine in ancient context and actually just think of like if you grew up going to school and at recess and you're picking teams.
Oh, like who gets picked first?
Something. Yeah, there's something about being first or just lining up for something. Oh, dude, my kids are at this all the time. They want to be first in whatever line it is, even if it's only three people, even if it's just my two boys. Mm. It's like a big deal who's in the front. And I'm constantly, trying to talk with them about this. Like, it doesn't matter. But to them, it does. There's something innate within them that being first, there's something primal to how humans imagine the world, that being first is somehow.
Okay, I get that. I get it feels good to be chosen first in kickball. I get that. I don't fully get the like, I need to be first in line.
Mm.
Like mom comes out to hand out popsicles. I gotta be first.
Yeah. Well, you really? That's just like, I want mine before somebody else. I want it now. That's the idea. I want it now. And if I'm second, then
I might not get the flavor I want.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it's primal. Sorry, but keep going on your theme. You're saying for you, that was, really? Even as a kid, you don't remember thinking that was important?
I can't remember feeling that was that important.
Yeah, I think because it's so, once you get socialized.
I probably just don't remember.
Yeah.
But,
Yeah.
There was definitely a concern of like, I don't want to be too far in the back of the line where I'm going to miss out.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
But you know, for me, actually, the first also comes with a little pressure of like, you can't see anyone. Like, how are they going to handle this?
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Like, maybe I can learn something from how the first person deals with this.
This is your firstborn, right? Position in your family.
Well, yeah, because I was the firstborn. And there is a trailblazing aspect of being the firstborn in a family.
Yeah. Yep.
And so when I was outside of the context of the family, it felt nice to kind of like be like, someone else, you go first. I'm gonna see how you handle this.
That's interesting. Yeah, I get that. I was the second born in my family, and I learned a lot by observing my older sister.
Okay.
I learned a lot. It definitely informed how I thought about my behavior and my decisions in my family. So, okay. In bringing this up, I'm just was trying to say there's something primal And there's something, I think, fairly universal in human nature that there's a desire to be first and that there's some sense that the first either gets the thing first or that it's a place of importance. I don't know.
There's also something really special about if you're a parent having your first child. Yeah. I mean, it represents like the beginning of your, you know, family in a way.
Yes.
And kind of the proof of like, we can do this, you know, like we can have kids. And there's so much joy and there's something so special about that first moment with your first child.
Yeah.
And then you have to retrain yourself and you learn when you have another kid, like this kid is just as special because they're completely different.
Yeah.
But there's something about the first. And I think in a culture where like now you're dependent on your kids, like it would just kind of make sense to be like, man, this first child like deserves to... he was here first.
Yeah. You know, there may also be something to the fact, just chronologically, that's the child that will develop first.
Oh, yeah.
And
become an adult first.
Yeah, become an adult first and therefore have the ability to, like, share the adult responsibilities
first. Very practical.
First. Yeah, that's a more practical observation.
Yeah.
So here's what's interesting is that this definitely was a practice in the ancient Near East surrounding the biblical authors and the timeline of the Bible. So there's actually only one law in the Torah, in Deuteronomy, that addresses it explicitly. And it's interesting. So this is in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 15 through 17. And this law is going to make your ears ring with the story of Jacob and Esau and of Jacob's wives, Rachel and Leah, from the book of Genesis. So if a man has two wives, so polygamy was common at a certain phase of ancient Near Eastern culture. If a man has two wives and the one is loved and the other unloved, and let's say both the loved and the unloved wives bear him sons. If the firstborn son, that is the chronologically first one, is the son of the unloved wife, then it will be in the day that he wills what he has to his sons. He
can't. Oh, and like inherits, or when he gives the inheritance.
Passes, the position of the firstborn to take over the authority of the family and take responsibility for wealth or property or whatever. The patriarch cannot make the son of the loved wife, the firstborn, before the son of the unloved, who is the actual firstborn.
Just because you have a favorite wife, like your firstborn is your firstborn.
Yeah. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, that son of the unloved wife, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his power. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. So there's actually a lot of fascinating things going on here. But it's clear this is in the backdrop of an assumption that, first of all, there's somehow this law of primogeniture, the right of the firstborn here. It's the Hebrew word bechora. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Language here. So Hebrew, the word firstborn is bechor, and it comes from the verb bachar, which is the verb to produce the first child. And it's actually this verb.
There's a verb for to produce a first child.
A first offspring. And it's a verb used of plants, animals, and humans.
Okay.
So like a wheat stalk.
Like the first head of grain?
Yes, it's first head of grain.
Oh.
Yeah. An animal.
We don't have a word for this, do we?
No, the closest would be adopting a King James-ism from this word, which is the first fruits.
First fruits?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, but that's a noun. This is a verb.
Oh, yeah, a verb to produce your first seed.
Yeah.
Your first offspring.
There's no verb.
Yeah, that counts for plants, animals, and humans.
Or even counts for either, any of them.
Yeah.
Right? What would you say? The first fruiting?
Well, you could say that calf was that cow's firstborn.
But that's
For a verb. I understand.
To bear a firstborn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a specific verb. So here, we're back into agricultural context.
Yeah. You know it's important when they have a verb for it.
A specific verb for bearing the first
And you know
offspring.
We've like gone very far from how they view it when we don't have a verb
okay,
for it.
Okay, there you go. Thank you. Thanks for thanks for being persistent on that.
Yeah.
I see your point, and it's a very good one. No, it's true. That's exactly right.
Bechor.
Bechor, yep.
Or no, bachar.
Bachar is the
produce,
verb.
Produce a firstborn.
Yep. Yeah, the first. And again, it can be used
for plants. Or a first
fruit. So first fruit. Yeah.
The first of the produce.
Yeah. Let's not forget that, again, given the agricultural context of the Hebrew Bible, that there's a deep analogy between the ground and the womb, and therefore between seed, like male reproductive seed, the fluid, and seeds that go into the ground. Mm. There's a deep analogy there. Mm. And then of the fruit of that union between seed and ground, which is fruit.
Yeah.
In the plant form or in the animal form, in the human form. Mm. The fruit of the womb.
The fruit of the womb.
Yep. Or the fruit of the ground. So there's a deep analogy in the biblical imagination between those two. And that's where this verb fits in. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting.
Yeah.
I have a hunch that in English, there might be a verb in agricultural lingo. It's just we wouldn't know it.
Oh, interesting. For a plant.
A plant's first
fruit.
Fruit,
yeah.
Like when a tree has its first fruit or a vine, there might be a verb for that.
Mm.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Someone knows.
There might be a verb for that. The Greek word used of the New Testament that is a title of Jesus, as we'll see in a little bit, is the Greek word, it's a compound word, prototokos.
Prototokos.
Prototokos. Compound, proto, first, and tokos, which is one who is born.
Proto.
Prototokos. Firstborn.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fairly straightforward. So prototokos was the Greek word used in the Septuagint, the first translation of the Hebrew Bible, which was into Greek.
Mm-hmm. To translate bechor.
To translate these Hebrew words. Yep. The noun bechor and the verb bechor. And then it was adopted into Greekified Judaism called Hellenistic Judaism and then into the New Testament.
Wait, say that again. Greekified Judaism?
Oh, Hellenistic Judaism,
uh-huh.
Which is the fruit of after Greek culture married with every other culture in the ancient world after Alexander the Great. But instead of calling it Hellenistic, I said first Greekified.
Greekified,
because that's what it
was. And what happened during?
Oh, well, a gazillion things happened.
I mean, but particular to this word?
Oh, for this word is that the Hebrew Bible and the way its language reflects a view of reality was, what do you say, tuned to a Greek cultural key in the first Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible.
Okay.
And that what became the predominant Bible of Greek-speaking Jews throughout the ancient world, throughout the diaspora in the Second Temple period. And Jesus and all of his first followers and the authors of the New Testament were the product of that Greek plus ancient biblical Hebrew marriage of
I'm really fascinated and diving deeper into that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah.
But it's all about culture, how language is a reflection of an assumed cultural way of viewing reality.
So they were reading the Hebrew Bible in Greek as their primary source?
Well, many people were.
Many people,
it was bilingual.
Okay.
But just the point is that the Hebrew Bible was tuned to a Greek key, as it were, once Hellenistic culture, you know, just reshaped the world. Okay. And the New Testament is the product of that marriage.
Right.
Well, it's not a product only of that marriage. There's a lot of other things.
Right.
But the language and imagery used in the New Testament is not just Hebrew Bible, fast forward a couple hundred years. It's Hebrew Bible tuned to the key of Hellenistic language and culture and thought.
Yeah.
Which is what makes the New Testament so rad. Because it's like the ultimate cross-cultural experience.
Wow.
I could tell.
That's new territory for us.
We're looking at a rabbit hole, a deep, deep rabbit hole in our conversation right now. And I can tell you're like.
Well, Part of the reason is I've been thinking a lot about the soul.
Mm. Oh, yes.
And
yeah.
I've been realizing that, like, there's something that happened mm-hmm. when the yeah. Hebrew Bible was Greekified.
Yep.
And is it that the idea developed, or it's just they got new language to talk about the same things they were always kind of talking
it's
about?
A great question.
And
Yeah, actually, I learned a lot. I learned a lot recently on a reading project I did. And I would love to talk about that more.
Sweet. All right.
So I think, have we sufficiently kind of explored this basic idea of yeah. this cultural background? So what's interesting, oh yeah, sorry. This was all a rabbit trail because we were talking about the law in Deuteronomy.
Oh yeah, the law in Deuteronomy.
Yeah, we didn't even finish talking about that. So what's interesting about this law in Deuteronomy, 20 minutes later, however long it was.
A man has two wives.
Is that
you lost me right
it
there.
Really, so this is assumes the practice of elevating the firstborn son.
Yeah.
The chronologically first son, if you're a polygamous family where a man has more than one wife. But what's interesting is that what the law is recognizing is that there will be situations
where you don't want to give the firstborn the rights.
The right of the firstborn will not be honored. Mm. It assumes that that happens.
Okay.
And so here's what's interesting, and this was new to me as I was learning about this topic, is that in the ancient Near Eastern literature, and so here I'm depending on a very helpful resource produced or edited, overseen by John Walton, who we've interviewed yeah. on the podcast before. He's a biblical scholar who really tries to make ancient Near Eastern cultural background more understandable, more accessible to normal Bible readers. Mm-hmm. So he oversaw the production of a whole commentary series called the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary, the ZIBBC.
That's the book for me.
It goes through the whole Old Testament, mm-hmm. and it will just go through every story and poem, giving you any relevant kind of cultural background stuff that you might not know, but that will illuminate or add some multidimensional color, to use many metaphors, to the story. So on this law, commentary on this law in Deuteronomy 21, he mentions that this law or right of the firstborn functioned in the ancient Near East, but not everywhere, nor was it always observed, even though everywhere present. Mm-hmm. So he goes through the Code of Hammurabi, gives some examples, ancient Assyrian laws, legal, like documents from all these ancient Near Eastern cities, Mari and Nuzi and Alalak. And what you find is there is a basic assumption, it's the same as the Hebrew Bible. There's a basic assumption that this practice of giving the firstborn son was the norm, but there were exceptions. And just like in the Hebrew Bible, there's a law addressing what if a dad wants to make an exception.
I see.
There are also laws that do make exceptions, also down in Egypt and Babylon and Assyria. But all the laws are usually little unique variations. So let's see. Like in Egypt, he gives an example. In Egypt, in the Middle Kingdom, the law primogeniture could be disregarded by a dying father. Property could be willed to a brother, for example. So here's an, you know, maybe the firstborn son is like incompetent or maybe he died or who knows? We don't know.
Yeah.
But the point is there's this law, you know, that states that or cultural practice that you could, your brother could stand in the place of the firstborn. So that's interesting. Uh-huh. But what the laws as a whole show is that it was a general practice, but that there were.
And the general practice, to be clear, in the Deuteronomy passage was to give a double portion.
That's right. Yeah.
Which means just twice as much as you give other people, other kids?
Yeah. So let's say you have five kids.
Yeah.
I guess you would divide it up six ways.
And then the firstborn gets
firstborn would get the double portion. That's the idea.
Was that common in these other cultures too? Was it the double portion mentality?
Yeah, interesting.
Do you think that changed?
Well, so here's what Walton says. So here's some ancient Indian laws called a collection of the laws of Lipit Ishtar, who is the king, which say that the inheritance of a father should go equally to the children of two wives. However, in Hammurabi's code, the first wife's firstborn receives a preferential share. So that's like the law in Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Although it's a little less concrete. What does that mean, that preferential share?
Yeah, that's true. Yep. There was an ancient Eastern city of Mari, documents found where there's a legal decision recorded to grant a double portion to the natural firstborn son. That's just like the law in Deuteronomy. in 15th century BC in the city of Nuzi, where another legal collection was discovered. The same exact laws followed.
Double portion.
In the city of Alalakh on the Orontes River, there's a text that mentions a father who was aware of but did not have to recognize the law of the firstborn in his will. So that's interesting. He could designate a first son. Oh, he could designate a first son for inheritance purposes. Maybe that's saying he could pick which
son gets to have the right of the firstborn.
Yeah. So same text from the city of Emar is the son receives an extra share. So I think he's collected here a bunch of ones that are similar.
Okay.
But then when he cites examples from Egypt, it's different. A guy could name his brother.
Yeah.
They do, you know, Egypt, they do things different down there.
Or their entire family could just be the trustee in the New Kingdom era.
In the New Kingdom era, he says the oldest son was the expected heir, but the whole family or an appointed trustee, yeah, could become the heir. So maybe for some reasons unique to Egypt, the institution or the practice had became less important.
Developed.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet there's a whole rabbit hole down there. Neo-Babylonian laws. The sons of a first wife receive two-thirds of the inheritance, while the sons of the second wife received one-third.
Okay.
Sons who were of different status might fare differently. So you get the feel like, okay, this was known.
There's a general sense.
Yes.
The firstborn mm-hmm. should get more. And then from that kind of agreed upon
yes.
status quo.
Yeah.
There's variations on
yes.
then what flexibility is there?
Yeah. So a lot more digging and details we could do, but we got the general portrait. Like, what is this practice? And that it was widespread in the ancient Near East, and that it's the general assumed backdrop of the biblical story. However, so this is a pivot. It's a new step in our conversation right now. When you get to the actual story, the biblical story that begins in Genesis, one of the most dominant themes in Genesis is how God, the creator God, is constantly subverting and inverting this practice of elevating the firstborn by God elevating or choosing or blessing or foregrounding the younger siblings over the actual firstborn at like every level of the story.
Happens over and over and over.
Yeah, that's right. So you mentioned Cain and Abel earlier.
Yeah, Cain's the firstborn, Abel's mm-hmm. secondborn. Mm-hmm. God favors Abel's offering. Yeah. Instead of Cain's.
That's right.
And immediately you should be thinking like, why? Why favor this secondborn?
Yeah. And while the story may or may not provide some details about why, I think the story does give little clues. But all that to say, it's the first time that happens between siblings.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Later, when you get to the descendants of Noah, and Noah has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, or Shem, Ham, and Japhet. What's interesting is that ordering of their names is not their birth order.
Mm.
The firstborn, or the older, is Japheth. And then there's ambiguity about the birth order of Shem and Ham. It seems likely that it was Japheth, then Shem, then Ham. It's interesting that Ham was the youngest of the three, which might explain the thing that he did in the tent.
Who did the thing in the tent?
Ham.
Ham.
Ham does some scandalous thing in a tent with his dad,
yeah,
looking on his dad's nakedness. And if he is the third born, that actually kind of helps make sense of what he's doing. He's trying to jump ahead in line.
Oh.
The family line. It happens again with Abraham and his brothers. And this isn't a big narrative.
So wait, with Noah's kids,
mm-hmm.
who gets the blessing?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Shem is the one who's blessed. And it said that Yahweh, the creator God, is going to come and dwell in the tents of Shem.
Okay. And so Yahweh chooses.
Yahweh, yeah.
The second or third born of Noah.
Yahweh chooses to associate himself and his presence and his name with Shem, who's not the firstborn.
Okay. Second time God chooses a clear latecomer.
That's right. When you get through the lineage of the biblical story, it goes through Shem, and it traces to a guy named Terach, who has three sons, Nahor, Haran, and Avraham.
Mm.
And there, God chooses and blesses and elevates, like Shem, the younger son, Abraham, over his older brothers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then one of those older brothers has a son named Lot, and Lot goes with Abraham to, you know, the land of Canaan, and then that causes all kinds of
Abraham's older brother has a son,
yep.
Lot,
mm-hmm.
Abraham's then nephew.
His nephew comes with, but what Lot represents is the family of his older brother.
Mm.
And so the tension between Lot and Abraham—
It's kind of like a sibling rivalry
is,
in a way.
Yeah, it's about that sibling rivalry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Then Abraham takes two wives. That's a whole story we've talked about many times in the mm-hmm. past. Hagar, who is a slave, but that he marries. So then he has two wives, Sarah and Hagar. And it's Hagar who has the firstborn son, Ishmael. And then Sarah bears Isaac, and the blessing
goes to Isaac.
Goes to Isaac and not to Ishmael. That continues with Isaac's two sons, where the firstborn is Esau. Secondborn is Jacob.
And this one, like, the volume's really turned up, I feel like.
The whole narrative of the tension between Esau and Jacob really focuses in. In fact, it's the story where the word firstborn and the noun the right of the firstborn is used for the first time.
And they're twins, so, mm-hmm. like,
yeah.
the status is, like, mere minutes.
Minutes, yeah, totally. Yeah, that's right.
And so it's like this, yeah.
And it's the theme of the birth story. Because Jacob comes out grabbing
at
his brother as if, you know, from birth, he's trying to get that position that his brother has. And it turns out that's a position that God has destined him for, is to have the position of the firstborn, even though he's not chronologically the firstborn. So what's interesting—
And obviously not like a guy with so much character that like—
No, he's terrible.
That God should give him the firstborn because you're not the firstborn, but you got so much—
Yeah, promise. So much
potential, Jacob.
You know, the whole point of the Jacob story is to show that, he's snaky, snake-like from the start, grabbing that heel. So there's a sibling rivalry in an inversion of the firstborn. But then what's interesting is that you go another layer deep. It's like in Inception, that movie Inception. Inversion of the firstborn within an inversion of the firstborn, because then the story of Jacob and his two wives also becomes a story of inverted firstborn because Jacob falls in love with a woman who is the secondborn. Her name's Rachel. He meets her at a well. You know, it's a great scene. And he wants to marry her. And his dad, Laban, says, absolutely. And then he pulls a fast one on him.
And gives him his firstborn daughter.
Yeah, who's Leah. And so Rachel is the loved. Leah is the unloved. It's actually the wording of
and
the
so
story.
That law we wrote read in Deuteronomy is hyperlinking to that story.
Exactly, yeah. And what the law is saying is, here in Israel, we're never going to do what Jacob did, which is favor the sons of the loved wife over the actual firstborn that came from the unloved wife. So then what's interesting is through those two wives and then their two slaves, Jacob produces a family of 12 sons and a daughter. And then the next cycle of Genesis is all about the rivalry and the inversion of the firstborn among the 12 brothers.
Yeah. So now we have the 12 brothers who are going to become the 12 tribes.
Yep.
And
the
standout brother of this whole story becomes Joseph.
Yeah. Among Rachel's sons with Jacob, it's Joseph becomes the favored one.
Mm-hmm.
And then among Leah's sons, it's the fourthborn Judah that becomes the prominent one. And the whole story is about this rivalry of Joseph and all his brothers, and then specifically this rivalry of Joseph and Judah.
Mm.
And the actual firstborn, Reuben, he's just left behind in the dust, as well as the second and thirdborn, Simeon and Levi. But the reason they're left in the dust is because each of them, there's a narrative about each of them doing something really terrible that disqualifies them in the eyes of their father.
Okay.
So that's interesting.
So this is all through Genesis. We just went through all the Genesis.
Yeah, totally.
It's like every turn.
Yes.
Like you would expect, well, the firstborn should be favored.
Yeah.
He's not.
Yeah. So, and how this fits in is that God is constantly subverting and overturning the natural human assumptions about power and privilege.
If the assumption is the firstborn should have the power, should have the privilege, should have the authority, God's saying like, well, maybe not.
Yeah. And really, this is all just a main theme in Genesis about good and bad, humans discerning good and bad. And so the assumed idea is the basic human assumption when it comes to the good and bad and the future of the family is that the firstborn son should be elevated overall. And sometimes what these humans do to put a son in that position of firstborn or to produce that firstborn
causes problems,
causes pain and grief and division and abuse.
Okay.
And so what God is constantly doing is subverting and overturning human assumptions about power and privilege. That's what all these inversions are about.
Yeah.
And that's a main narrative theme throughout Genesis. Hmm. And it just continues to echo throughout the rest of the Hebrew Bible. Moses and Aaron, for example.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Aaron's the firstborn.
Is he?
Aaron's the older brother.
Oh.
Yep.
No way.
Yeah. And so he's chosen for the role of the high priest, but the first thing, even before he steps into his job, he's leading the people into idolatry. And it's the younger brother who God elevates to the top of Mount Sinai to, you know, and he intercedes and rescues for the people. Of Aaron's sons, Aaron has four sons, and the first two, in their first day on the job in the tabernacle, do break, you know, violate protocol. And so God takes their lives and elevates the third born, Eleazar, to the place of the honored son. This happens with, my favorite place this motif gets explored is in the opening chapters of Samuel with the story of Hannah and the birth of Samuel. Hmm. Because Hannah is married to this guy named Elkanah, and Elkanah has another wife, Peninnah, and Peninnah has all these sons and is able to produce fruit of the womb, but Hannah cannot. Hmm. But interestingly, Elkanah loves Hannah more, but Peninnah has the place of social prominence in the family because she can produce children.
Yeah.
And so the whole story is about how God chooses and elevates and gives a special gift to Hannah over and above Peninnah. And then that is the gift of Samuel, her son, who she surrenders over to become a Nazarite, to like a virtual high priest. Uh-huh. And he lives in and around the temple. And then the actual high priest at the time, Eli, has these older sons who were like terrible guys. And God elevates the little Samuel, the little boy Samuel.
Who's not even a Levite.
Yeah, over the priestly line. Super cool story. Hmm. David.
Yeah.
David is the youngest son.
This one, this one stands out to me. I wouldn't have thought of Moses. Mm-hmm. Samuel wouldn't have come to mind. Mm-hmm. But yeah, David.
David.
This is the classic story of like, he's small in stature.
Yeah.
He's
out in the field taking care of the sheep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's not even in the running at first.
Yeah. And actually this is in 1 Samuel chapter 16. The main point of the story is God tells the prophet to go to the house of this guy who has a son, who am I going to elevate as king? And so in the story, it's such a great story. So in the story, Samuel, this is the Samuel the prophet, is told to go to the house of this guy, Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have seen for myself a king among his sons. So Samuel goes to his house, and he has Jesse line up all his sons. This is great for Samuel 16, verse 6. And when the sons came, Samuel looked upon Eliab, the firstborn, and he thought, oh, surely the Lord's anointed one is now before the Lord. But the Lord said to Samuel, don't look upon his appearance. Don't look at the height of his stature, because this guy, Eliab?
Not the guy.
Not the guy. For the Lord does not see as humans see. Humans look on the appearance of the outside, but the Lord looks on the heart. So then Jesse says, okay, second born, come on up. Abinadab. He makes him pass before Samuel. And Samuel says, nope.
There's a classic storytelling here now.
Totally. Then Jesse made third born, Shammah, pass by. Nope, Samuel says. Jesse made seven sons, passed before Samuel. Then Samuel said to Jesse, nope, none of these has the Lord chosen. Are these all your sons? And then Jesse says, oh, well, there is the youngest.
There's the runt.
The runt. And he's the one. So it's clearly this story is turning up the volume on this theme here.
Yeah, yeah.
And notice here, it once again, it's about human expectations about power and privilege.
Yes. Yeah, very clearly here.
Mm-hmm. The tallest, you know, in theory, the strongest.
Uh-huh.
Or the firstborn with the firstborn right.
Yeah, the order he goes through the sons is mm-hmm. from first to last in birth order.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that story clearly is turning up the volume here. So what's fascinating is not only is David elevated over his brothers, but then when he's elevated over to become king in the place of Israel's first king, Saul, David is also elevated over Saul's firstborn, Jonathan. Hmm. Jonathan is the firstborn to become king
yeah.
after Saul. And Jonathan can see that God's chosen David. And there's that famous story where he gives him all these special items and says, you're the chosen one, not me. So Solomon, next generation, Solomon is David's son, but I forget what order. He's not the firstborn.
Bathsheba's first?
He's Bathsheba's first, but David had many wives.
Yeah.
And the sons in line for the role of firstborn are Absalom, who's then killed, and then another son named Adonijah. In the rivalry between David and Absalom, and then between Solomon and Adonijah are the main focus of the beginning of the Book of Kings. So this is a major theme throughout the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, big deal.
Yeah.
A lot of these stories don't really land unless
yeah.
are tuning into this theme.
That's right. Yeah.
So much focus on these sibling rivalries.
Correct. And why the David story is so important is because it's saying explicitly what has been going on implicitly throughout the whole Bible with this theme is that Yahweh is opposed to human institutions of power and privilege that distort our perception of what is good and bad.
We have an idea
yeah.
of what is good.
Mm-hmm.
And the good is the first one.
Yeah.
Or the biggest.
Yep.
The most powerful.
Yes.
That's the good.
That's the good.
And what's good is to make sure that I create a firstborn
mm-hmm.
and that I am in control mm-hmm. of things
mm-hmm.
and all of that
mm-hmm.
ends up creating so much strife
in the stories. That's right. Yeah.
And then God comes
strife in. Meaning humans taking advantage of each other,
yeah,
tricking each other, abusing,
deception, violence,
sexual abuse, murder. It's like the worst of human nature on display,
yeah,
in trying to elevate or produce firstborn sons.
Yeah,
it's a major repeated theme. And so this practice of God in subverting it is a major theme of the Hebrew Bible. The God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Actually, that's a proverb.
Mm.
And we just tend to think proud and humble as being individual character dispositions. But in an honor-shame culture that's very much about social rank and hierarchy, the proud are those who would assert high social rank for themselves, and the humble are those who have a low social position.
Mm.
And God loves to, or as Job will say it multiple times, he'll bring down the mighty. Or no, Hannah says it in her song.
Oh, yeah.
He loves to bring down the mighty from their thrones and elevate those sitting in the dust to the seat of nobles and princes.
Mm.
That's what this is about.
Is Jesus riffing on this, when the first will be last and last will be first?
Absolutely. When his disciples come to him and say, hey, we're wondering who's...
who gets to sit at your right and left?
Right hand, or like, which one of us is the greatest?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and Jesus is just like, oh my gosh. Yeah, those who want to be first are actually the last, and those who take position of the last will be the servant. So yeah, Jesus is distilling this key theme of the Hebrew Bible into these teachings. Okay, so all of that being said, here's the puzzle. Here's a fascinating little puzzle.
Okay.
So after all...
Yeah, it's very clear that God is not down with the firstborn for the sake of the firstborn.
Yeah, that's right. If it's too strong to say that God's opposed to this practice, it's at least to say what God is opposed to is people abusing each other, hurting each other, in order to get their children or produce a firstborn heir.
You'd almost feel like he's opposed to it.
Yeah, but exactly, totally, yeah, inherently. So this, that you walk away from the Hebrew Bible going, okay, I get it, I get what this God's about, right? If he may be anti-firstborn, all right, to put it maybe a little hyperbolically, or that he...
It's highly suspicious.
Highly suspicious of that this institution can do anything good for humans.
Yeah.
So isn't it interesting that when you get to the story of Jesus, what the four gospel accounts claim about Jesus, what's explicit in the letters of Paul, it's explicit in the letter to the Hebrews, and in the Revelation. So in all the layers and parts in the New Testament, there is a very clear emphasis on Jesus's identity as the firstborn, as the firstborn son, the son of God, God's special firstborn with the right to power and authority and responsibility over all of creation.
And not necessarily being born first in his family as much as like this idea of like,
yeah,
it's just almost like meta idea of like the firstborn of, well, as Paul would say, the firstborn of creation.
Yeah. So in, for example, Colossians chapter 1, Jesus is called the image of the invisible God.
Okay.
So using the phrase from Genesis
the
1.
The image of God.
And then he equates it in terms of poetic parallel lines, the firstborn over all creation.
Yeah.
So to be the image of God is to be in the position of the firstborn of all creation. Then he calls Jesus a few lines later, he is the beginning.
The first.
The firstborn from among the dead. So he's claiming for Jesus to be the preeminent representation of the Father over all creation and to be the beginning and source of the new creation that is the resurrection from the dead. So what's interesting here is that Jesus, and you're like, oh, I guess God is down for the right of the firstborn. Because I guess Jesus holds that place in the universe. So he's not always opposed to it.
Okay.
It just seems like he was. In Romans chapter 8, Jesus is called the image. What Paul is talking about is God has called and purposed that a group, that a human family would form to be transformed into the image of his son so that his son would become the firstborn among many siblings. So the plan of God was always that the human family would be perfectly transformed into the image of the firstborn.
So here the idea is there's a firstborn of a family, we get that, but then it's like taking that idea to another level and saying there's a firstborn of all of humans.
Of all creation.
Of all creation. I don't know what that means. We can talk about that.
Yeah, later. Yep.
But then here, the firstborn of
a family.
Of many brethren.
Yeah.
The idea of like the whole human family.
Yeah, that's right.
Like he's the first.
Yep. He holds the status of the firstborn over a whole family of brothers and sisters. And they are all being transformed into the image of that firstborn son. That's the idea here. So when you get into the letter to the Hebrews in chapter 1, and then in chapter 12, once again, Jesus is called the firstborn. And in both cases, It's a place of status and honor. All creation is called to bow down and worship, specifically heavenly beings. Angels are called down to worship the firstborn. That's in Hebrews chapter 1. And then in chapter 12, the community of Jesus' followers is called the assembly of the firstborn, or in some translation, it's the word ecclesia, church, the church of the firstborn. Hmm. So instead of saying the church of Jesus, you could just say the church of the firstborn.
It's like a title for him.
Yes. And then in the Revelation, the last book of the Christian Bible, in Revelation chapter 1, verse 5, Jesus is called the faithful witness, the firstborn from among the dead, the ruler of the kings of the land. Hmm. So being the faithful witness, being the one who has stood faithful, telling, bearing witness to the truth about the Father, that's equated to having the status of the firstborn, and then that's equated to being the ruler of the kings of the land. But it's an interesting puzzle because all of a sudden, it's sort of like God is not down for humans who connive and scheme their way to become or get their child to be the firstborn. All throughout the Hebrew Bible, it makes me think, I guess God's anti-firstborn. But then you turn to the New Testament, and the story gets a little more complex yet again.
Yeah, because the firstborn is really a theme about authority mm-hmm. and power. Mm-hmm. Right?
Responsibility
comes with that.
Representation. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
And so you could think, as you read the Bible, oh, so God's not down with giving that authority to someone just basically because of when they showed up on the scene.
That's right.
But he is interested in making sure someone does have that
place.
That place.
Yeah.
And then there's a kind of a lineage that goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess to try to understand, what's the puzzle? The puzzle is, when we get to Jesus, why isn't he celebrated as a second born?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that with all of this emphasis in the New Testament saying Jesus holds the place and status of the eternal firstborn within the very being of God. The community that is the one God, Father, Son, and Spirit. The puzzle is you would think that God is anti this institution or practice of just because the firstborn son has that role inherently, that son deserves the right to have power and authority. But then the whole claim about Jesus is he actually is holds legitimately, out of all the humans in the story, here is the one who can truly legitimately be called the firstborn because
he actually is the firstborn.
He actually is the Son of God.
But he also is chosen, and he also is the one who does pass the test. And like he does kind of like, you know, it all comes together.
Yeah. So what's interesting, the gospel authors want to retain both themes, both ideas, because what they're constantly going to show is Jesus' humble origins.
Yeah.
The poor family that he comes from, that he,
outside
even though he's born in the city of David, Bethlehem, he's not from there.
Yeah.
He's from a, you know, rural hill country up in Galilee, from Sticktown, Nazareth. He's not trained in Jerusalem. He's not a Bible scholar with traditional credentials. So all of that is portraying Jesus as the outsider, the younger sibling, the one who holds a place of low social rank.
Okay.
And then being crucified as a criminal.
But then this New Testament theology, as it comes and says, surprise, like he actually has this identity.
Yeah.
That's so firstborn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a new category of firstborn. It's firstborn over all of creation.
Yeah. That's right. You could say the story from Jesus' birth, from his incarnation to the cross and the resurrection, is a story in historical time of the subversion of the firstborn.
Okay.
Because Jesus, right, all this humble origins, he's the outsider. And that's the one that God elevates to the position of the firstborn. And so that's the narrative. But then that narrative is framed within a wider claim to say the one whom God has exalted by raising him to be, you know, the Son of Man over heaven and earth. That one was and always has been the eternal Son of God who legitimately holds that place of representation.
Who existed from the beginning.
Who is the beginning.
He is the beginning.
He is the beginning and the end. So he is legitimate firstborn. So it's this interesting, God both subverts this pattern,
yeah.
But what he's subverting is not the idea that God should have a true representative son.
Mm.
What he's opposing is the way that humans try to scheme and create and get that power through a redefinition of good and bad. And so Jesus becomes like the model, the true model of what the legitimate firstborn is and should be, which is a model of humility and love and self-giving compassion.
Yeah.
But it's this kind of this cool twist
yeah.
in the way the New Testament tells the story of Jesus. So that's kind of the big picture.
Yeah, we did the whole thing.
I guess we just did the whole thing. What we can do now, we just painted the whole picture.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what would be fun to do is go back and dive into some of these specific moments of God inverting this practice. Oh, and actually, specifically to talk about that Cain and Abel, I don't think is the first time that this theme appears.
Hmm.
It appears with Adam and Eve's relationship to the sky rulers and to the animals, I think is where the first time this theme appears. And if you think I'm crazy, there's a bunch of Second Temple Jewish literature to show you that I'm not.
The theme first appears at, what did you say, Adam's relationship?
Adam and Eve's relationship.
Adam and Eve's relationship
with the sky rulers and to the animals.
The sky rulers being heavenly beings.
Yep. Sky rulers are first.
They're first.
They come on day four.
Oh,
the animals.
They're created, or they're appointed first.
Yes. The animals are first on day six of creation. The animals come first.
Okay.
But it's the latecomers, the humans.
The humans.
Who are the last ones to arrive in the Genesis 1, they are the ones that are given rule and authority over.
They're given the image of God.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into it.
That's what we'll talk about next.
Awesome.
There we go.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Bible Project Podcast. Next week, we're going to dive in to the first place where this theme takes root. And if the theme of the firstborn is about sibling rivalry and God choosing the younger brother over the older, you would think the first story to look at is the story of Cain and Abel. But in fact, this theme begins earlier in Genesis 1 through 2, where Yahweh makes rulers of the sky and rulers of the land, spiritual beings above to represent God and humans below. The humans are the latecomers, the dirt creatures, less glorious than the spiritual beings above, but it's the humans who are given authority to rule.
The human rulers come last in the sequence of the 6 days. They don't come first, they come last. Even the animals are before them. The last comer is the one who is given the authority to rule over the land. But isn't it interesting, as you read through the Hebrew Bible, it's consistently the latecomer that God elevates to places of rule and authority.
Today's episode is produced by Cooper Peltz with the associate producer, Lindsay Ponder. Edited by Dan Gummel, Tyler Bailey, and Frank Garza. Hannah Wu provided the annotations for our annotated podcast and our app. Bible Project is a crowdfunded nonprofit, and we exist to experience the Bible as a unified story that leads to Jesus. Everything that we make is free because it's already been paid for by thousands of people just like you. Thank you so much for being a part of this with us.
Hi, this is CJ and Sarah.
And we're from Euless, Texas.
We first heard about the Bible Project from my mother.
We use the Bible Project to deepen our study of the Bible and discuss what we're learning together.
Our favorite thing about the Bible Project is it shows how connected the Bible is through its themes and design patterns.
We believe the Bible is a unified story that leads to Jesus. We're a crowdfunded project by people like us. Find free videos, study notes, podcasts, classes, and more at BibleProject.com.